FM.
Howdy, this is Rusty Young of Poco, and you're listening to Peter Rodman.
Actually, this is Peter Rodman, and I'm Richie Furay.
Hi, this is Randy Meisner.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Cotton.
This is Rick Lotto.
Hello. This is Michael Webb.
Hi, this is Jack Sundred, and you are listening to Peter Rodman Goes Off on WXNALP.
Nashville.
Would you say it's a tougher go today than it was when you began, way back?
I don't really think so. I think there are just more groups, there may be a little more competition, but the Springfield had it just as tough. Poco had it just as tough. I can remember playing over night after night after night in little, just little clubs, trying to break those two groups,
Morning, Peter Rodman here with you. I'm very excited. It's Poco time, and we're going to wind up our month-long tribute to Rusty Young today. Rusty passed away in mid-April, and he changed steel guitar forever, but also kept Poco going for 53 years, and that's amazing even to the other members. We'll talk with the guys who formed Poco, Richie Furay, and in a rare interview, Jim Messina on the telephone. Also, we'll talk with Paul Cotton, another guy that does not do too many interviews. These are all from my archive of stuff. I mean, to tell you the truth, there are so many hours of interviews with all these guys that I probably didn't listen to most of it. Richie alone, for example, we did 8 to 10 hours of interviews over the years, and also kind of hung out a little bit in Boulder, back where Poco lived for a while. Paul Cotton, same thing, but less interviews because he's not that big a talker. Rusty Young, old friend, so caught him. The one I listened to that I liked best is an interview we did backstage at a stadium show with the Doobie Brothers, Boston, Poco, Firefall. It was like a big event, 60,000 people. And there's Rusty graciously talking to me and taping an interview backstage. So you'll overhear other bands, but it's kind of cool. Another couple of guys came over last week and taped their comments. Rick Lotto and Michael Webb, recent Poco members, who just wanted to put in their heart and their two cents. So big day today. Stay tuned. Here's Poco, and we're going to talk it all over from the inside on WXNA LP, Nashville.
Been needing some love, and I find
you're just tuning in, good morning, Peter Rodman here, and I'm smiling ear to ear because Poco has that effect on me. It's all up music. Even the sad stuff, I just enjoy it. A lot of great harmonies, and really, they are as much responsible for country rock as anyone. Formed from the ashes of Buffalo Springfield. I did talk to Richie Furay about that, and I found this little bit of tape pretty soon after he kind of converted or became a born-again Christian. And this puzzled a lot of people, as it always does when a rock star goes in that direction. But Richie kind of demystified it for me, and here's a piece of that conversation from March 12th, 1978 on WXNA LP Nashville.
One thing I think that intrigues everyone is has been your recent, now I wouldn't say conversion, but your recent emphasis on religion.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that too much has been made of that in terms of music?
I think the press always likes to sensationalize, you know, and it's been the greatest thing that's ever happened to my life, and a lot of people, it puts them uptight, you know, and I'm sorry for that. But all I can say is that it has made room for a lot of sensationalism, you know. I think any time the press can, you know, sensationalize something, they will, you know. And so happens that's an easy one. You know, to sensationalize.
Right.
And
I can tell you now, folks, he has not shaved his head. There's no orange sneakers here, so we don't have any kind of fanaticism. You always seem to be an optimist, though, I must say. In the music, Polka has got to be associated with smiles and happiness all around.
Yeah, I think especially the musical end, up until, as far as I'm concerned, up until about the good feeling to know period. And I had a friend of mine back in New York, Peter Nobler, who's the editor of Crawdaddy magazine. He came up and told me, says, you know, your music is all so happy, but I read your lyrics and they seem to be not down, but they can confuse you, you know, because the music is so up and the lyrics seem to be just over here. So it was at that point that I started writing Good Feeling to Know, and I sort of have taken more or less an optimistic, you know, viewpoint on the lyrical content of my songs now. And all the songs are really very personal songs, of which I try to leave room for you, you know, or whoever, to take in to their own personal life. But I've tried to make it more optimistic than pessimistic.
How would you say it's changed you personally, though? Religion or beliefs?
Well, it's just taken a lot of weight off my shoulders. You see, in my Christianity, I feel that I don't have to do some of the things that I thought I had to do before. And it's just, it gives you a chance just to relax a little bit behind all the other stuff that's just going on around you daily.
Especially in the rock and roll world.
Yeah. I used to come down the mountain or you'd be driving. I was living in L.A. and New York. It was really critical times there. And I was the kind of guy that I just wouldn't even like to pull up to a stoplight if it was red. You know, and I'd, but, you know, I think everybody goes through a bunch of changes. They get older and they mature a little bit more. And I hope that that's what's happened to me. You know, I feel it has. I feel I've matured a little bit. Can I say I feel great?
We'll be right back.
You've seen a lot of your friends become very, very big stars. And there must have been an element of not only frustration, because you're equally talented, but an element of change observed in them. And I won't be specific, but you've seen a number of people become very big. Is it ever very depressing to see what happens to someone when they get to be a quote-unquote star?
Well, maybe this is all just, you know, a little lesson and a little learning period while I wait. I can, like, flip through the pages of my friends, you know, and sort of check out what's happened to them. You know, so, I mean, it's a very ironic thing. I continue to put out records year after year, and I'm looking for that successful record that will, you know, maybe catapult me to that level, you know, that you're speaking of. But then at the same time, you know, when I do look at what has happened to some of my friends, they're probably some of the loneliest people that I know, you know, and that doesn't interest me a bit.
So you would definitely trade nothing to become, well, you put that better, you would definitely not trade anything dear to you in the way of friendship to make it.
No. Why? That's ridiculous. Never.
Just making that clear. We're talking
believe me, there's a certain struggle that goes on within me, but the bottom line is I know what's happening, you know, and I know what's happening with my life, and as much as I would like to see my records, you know, really sit on the top of the charts, which every artist would, because when he writes from, you know, from way down deep inside, and I'd like everyone to be able to, you know, to share that with me. There are other things, you know, if I had to weigh, I made that decision a long time ago, you know, and maybe that's, you know, I'm sure if I lived in Los Angeles right now that my career might have moved along at a little steadier pace, but I'm not sure that I'd be in the same mental place that I'm in right now had I stayed out there, you know.
And that little bit is from an interview recorded at my kitchen table in Boulder, Colorado on October 4th, 1979. So we're reaching way back. And interestingly enough, the day before that interview, unrelated completely to it, Jim Messina called up because he was talking about a new album of his called Oasis. And Richie at that time was plugging I Still Have Dreams, produced by our friend Val Garay. So it's interesting, but the two interviews are completely not connected, and yet I still wanted you to hear Jim Messina's version of history, because it's interesting to catch these great people at various stages of their life and what their perspective is at that time. Here's Jim Messina on WXNA LP Nashville.
Okay, now if I could go back again to some ancient history for you, I'm real curious. When you first came into Buffalo Springfield, it seemed, now I'm going to tell you from a fan's view, it seemed as though they were more or less at the end of their tether, and you sort of pulled that third album together. Fair enough?
Well, I think that my presence there in terms of new blood was a help to them, and I think they enjoyed having my energy around because I wasn't caught up in what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mainly had been their recording engineer on their second album.
Listen to my bluebird laugh. She can't tell you why. Deep within her heart, you see. She knows all I cry. She sits aloft at birds, strangest color blue, lying is forgotten now, things only of you, just you. She got soul.
I think my energy definitely helped to keep it together a little bit longer, but, you know, everybody has to be in the same place to work indefinitely, or at least for the time period that it takes to build real success.
Of course, there was Poco, yourself, and Richie Furay, along with Rusty Young, various bass players in the early days, Randy Meisner, Tim Schmidt. What caused you to leave Poco? Was it the same sort of thing, needing a break?
Yeah, needing a break, and also basically wanting to change my musical direction, too. I didn't know where I wanted to go with it. I didn't know what my potential was, but I thought at that point in time that maybe I should just stop and produce records, be around a lot of musicians and people that were doing different things in order to find what I really wanted to do and spend some time with my wife and try to work my music thing at home more so than traveling.
If you're just tuning in, good morning. Peter Rodman here going off with you and Poco this morning. Just winding up a four-week tribute to Rusty Young by kind of incorporating the stories of all the individual members that he worked with at various times of the band. You know, it's funny because along the way, just now, okay, I'm sitting here near the tape archive, and I thought, I know I have something better than a phone call with Jimmy. I've got stuff from lots of years, but everything's organized chronologically. And I thought, I think it was 94, and sure enough, I go back and find this clip from 1994, which is what? Let's see. 89, that's 15 years after the phone call you just heard part of on WXNA LP Nashville. Just a few more words with Jim Messina.
The very best, greatest years for Poco, for me, were surrounding that second album when they would hit the stage. And I'm a New Yorker originally, mm-hmm. So Boston and New York being your bastions of rabid fanatics.
They were definitely our feed bags in those days.
And when you would hit the stage, whether it be the Singer Bowl or Central Park or wherever Poco was, with the first notes to hurry up, and George Grantham would start slamming the drums, and you just, there was an exuberance about that group, oft attributed to Richie Furay alone, but mm-hmm. I think which largely came from Jim Messina. Do you feel sometimes like some of the best music you've done's gotten buried there in albums that can hardly be found anymore?
I think some of what you're saying is true for me too. The Hurry Up was one of my favorite tracks. El Tanto de Nadie, which followed Don't Let It Pass By, which was one of the songs that Richie wrote that I love. I love sonically how that record all came together. It was all recorded live in the studio. In those days, I would rehearse the band, and we'd go in and cut everything live, which was part of why it felt good.
I've talked about this before, but there are so many shows on this radio station that I just love, and I'm a regular listener to. One of them I haven't talked about in many moons, and it's a crime because he has, I think everyone would agree, I don't know if they would, but I'd be shocked if they didn't agree, that he has the greatest radio voice among us all down here. This guy, his name is Scotty, and every Friday afternoon, Rock and Roll High School just knocks it out of the park. It's from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. And, you know, have you ever gone to a butcher and you found the choice cuts? That's what Scotty does. It's all stuff that you either just vaguely remember or that you really hunger to hear more of, and he's got it all. So it's that, and frankly, for me, it's the voice. I was once told by a radio station owner, he said, "Peter, you sound like you're in junior high school. You're a nice guy, but get out of the business." And he was right. But I've gotten away with this for 45 years now, and Scotty, I've known for at least 25 of those years, and what a voice, what a show. Rock and Roll High School, Friday afternoons, 3 to 5 on WXNA LP, Nashville. All right, now, we're going to try something different. As part of this Poco special, I'm going to play the entirety of a track from their second album, Poco's second album, which was just self-titled, called Poco. And El Tanto de Nadie Regresa is a song written by all the members together back then: Richie Furay, Jim Messina, Rusty Young, Timmy Schmidt, and George Grantham. It's a terrific jam, but perhaps this is a high crime. I'm going to let some of the originals talk about their experiences right over the track, because I don't have more than an hour here total. So just get right to it right now. This is Poco on WXNA, and you'll be hearing some of the voices that I just mentioned.
What are some of your fondest onstage memories? Something crazy that happened with Poco?
With Poco, not too much craziness happened, except when we were headlining in the Mahavishnu Orchestra. It was his name, John McLaughlin.
Yeah.
Opened up for us. We were headlining, and he was so loud and so intense and so musical and so awesome that he blew out everybody's ears in the audience. And when we came on, it was like playing to an audience that had their brains removed. And so the next show, we asked if we could please open the show and let him close it, because it was too much to follow. Actually, stranger things happened in Loggins and Messina, and when you want to get into that, we will.
Go ahead. What happened with Loggins and Messina?
I think one of the strangest concerts I've ever done in my life was in Florida, and we were playing on a barge that was about 30 feet into the water, and next to that was sand, and then there was grandstands, and I guess they were boat shows that went on. And I think probably 15,000 people showed up to this show, and all the kids, it was college break time, hotter than hell, and all the kids had surfboards and surf mats, and they were all in front of the stage, and it was so weird to be playing, and your audience, instead of being in chairs, were on, you know, surf mats and surfboards. And
floating
in the water, you know, and it was going like this, and about three quarters away to the set, when we started breaking into Angry Eyes, the women started going crazy and pulling their tops off, and it was just total nudity in the front row, and it was very, very difficult to hang onto my composure.
Composure. Thank you for using the word composure.
Between Springfield and Poco, there was really maybe 7 months or so before, and we had to put a band together, get it organized, get the songs, get the record deals. By December the 5th of 1968, we signed our CBS deal, and by that spring, we were, you know, on and doing what we had to do. And then subsequent to Poco, I left on October 31st of 1970. By November, I hadn't met Kenny. And by January, we were rehearsing and working and working every day, 7 days a week, to get this band together. And then once that started, it was finding managers and agents. And by the time, you know, 1976 rolled around, I was burnt. I really was burnt. And I had very little time to myself. I didn't really have a teenagehood, as you might say. And I just needed a break.
We're talking with Jim Messina. He is, first of all, I want to thank you again for doing this, because this is really a privilege. And
I will send you the bill.
A lot of fun. Actually, send it to Val Garay. We noticed early on, I think lots of your fans who connect the dots between Buffalo Springfield, the early seminal Poco records, and Loggins and Messina, noticed that plucked guitar style. It's a Fender.
And it was, yes, indeed.
And I'd like you to just, for the musicians among the crowd, explain some of the trademark Jim Messina sound, how that comes about, because it's distinctive. If I heard it, I think I could identify that styling on any record, and that's a remarkable thing to have accomplished, your own guitar style.
I think what happened was that I started working with Stephen Stills, who used finger picks, and in order to play with him and do what I think needed to happen, I had to learn that style. But what happened is, once I left Buffalo Springfield, which I was a bass player in, and I only accompanied Stephen to learn the tune so I could, you know, transpose it into the bass parts, the picks have nickel in them and brass, and it would eat the cuticles of my fingers and they'd start to burn. And I, one night on stage when we were opening up at the Troubadour, they went, "Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we would like to introduce," and all of a sudden there was a bing, and my finger pick had gotten caught on my E string and shot across the room, and you can't play with one, so I threw the other one off, and it was so imbalanced having a thumb pick that I pulled it off and stuttered through the first few bars and played it on my fingers. And after that I said, I will never ever put on another set of finger picks, as far, you know, as long as I live. So I learned to play without any picks. And Larry Nekto was also kind of instrumental in that, because as a keyboard player, you know, they play, you know, at least 8 notes at a time. And a lot of the passages that I wanted to create, you can't strum it, you got to pull it. So then I would learn to play keyboard parts with my hands so I could get those inversions. And after a while, it sort of just evolved into being able to be chordal and also, you know, be able to do arpeggios.
Lots of people forget that Randy Meisner of the Eagles was first in Poco and left before they even put out album number one, Picking Up the Pieces. Here is an interview with Randy that I did February 28th, 1981. Let's see, that's that's 40 years ago. Oh, God.
Some of you may remember his tenure with Poco, although I don't believe that was ballyhooed on the first album, was it? That was kind of a low profile you had.
Yeah, first album. And
yet weren't pictured on the cover.
No, I quit because I wasn't allowed in the studio for the mixdown.
Is that true?
Yes, but I realize now why. And that is because Jimmy Messina and Richie Furay were more experienced at the time, and I was a young punk, and I wanted to be there. But I felt if I couldn't be there for the mix down, that was it. So I called them, and I said, if I can't come for the mix, I'm out of the group. And they said, fine.
They had, I guess, already rehearsed Timmy Schmidt, and the irony is that not only did he succeed you in Poco, but he succeeded you in the Eagles. Why did you leave the Eagles? A lot of people are going to wonder, and I'll get that question out of the way in the start.
Because I've always been singing very high parts and playing bass,
right,
and never been able to really express myself singing. And I figured it was time to do it.
The Eagles organization is such a tightly run, almost uptight ship. And I wonder if that bothered you too along the way. The fact that they couldn't say anything without checking with their managers first.
Well, I don't think they had to check with their managers, but it was it was too sterile for me. I like music that has fun in it, and it was too technical.
Are there high points though, that you remember that maybe more...
I'm proud of everything I did with the Eagles, but it just was a little, I like a little more looseness on stage and be able to, you know, have fun and jump around.
All right, we're going to go back just a little further in time now with Rusty Young. That's right. He's the man we're kind of paying homage to for these last 4 weeks, including today. Now, keep in mind, this is May 13th, 1979. Okay, I was, I don't know, 27. Rusty died this year. He was 75 this year. But 1979... gosh, that's 42 years before. So, in that context, you can listen to our excitement and weariness of how long Poco had been together. 11 big years. He kept them together for 53 years, ultimately. So, it's kind of funny. And so, let's get to the tape right now. Recorded backstage at a packed stadium. 60,000 people out front watching the Doobie Brothers, Boston, Poco, Firefall, whoever. It was a lot of people. And Rusty graciously took time to just sit with me and relax backstage and talk about Poco.
I want to, first of all, it's been such a long haul for Poco. Do you have any reflections now after what is it, 12 years or so?
11, I think. Do I have any reflections? It's been a great trip. It really has. The whole thing has been phenomenal.
Some of us who followed you over the years through, you know, thick and thin, and I suppose mostly thin in terms of hit singles,
yeah,
were
sure.
Pleasantly surprised by the fact that it was just another great Poco song that finally got up there. No compromises, no disco, no crazy stuff. How did you feel when you...
Crazy stuff.
Crazy, yes. Excuse me, folks. When you finally get up there, I mean, did it feel the way you thought it would feel? Having that big a hit single and now following it up with one that looks to be Heart of the Night.
Yeah, maybe bigger. It's great. I mean, it's what you've always worked for in the band, and all the other guys have got them. You know, our friends in other bands, they all have these hits that are big hits that people really like, and we've always worked to try and have that. And it's thrilling when it happens, I'll tell you, to look out and see the people singing along and see people, and you know they're really interested, they're really involved, and they really like the music, you know. It's a tremendous thing.
You're the only original member of Poco, although Paul Cotton is an honorary original member.
Yeah, he's been in the band about 8 years, I think, 8 or 9. So.
And that's longer than most people stay with most bands.
Yeah, that's right. Paul and I have worked together a long time.
Now, you've been through, again, a couple of key personnel shifts, with Richie Furay leaving way back, and then Tim Schmidt. Oh, Messina at first, right? You know, Poco's been like a graduating class for so many people. Were there times along the way when you felt like kind of a loner, keeping it together as you did? You really persevered here, and it finally paid off. But what happened in between?
Well, you know, I think that the original band we started out with were five really talented guys, and I really think that we were all equally talented. You know, there wasn't anybody who was monstrously more talented than anyone else, and that's part of the reason the band couldn't stay together is because you had five guys who had to do their own thing. You know, that sounds corny and all, but it's really true. The fact that everyone made it to the degree that they did, I guess, bears it out. You know, Jimmy's done great, and Richie's done real well, and Randy Meisner, he did great with the Eagles, and now Tim's with the Eagles, he's doing fine, and now Paul and I with the Pokes, you know, we're doing great. We're having the time of our life, you know. So it's really been nice, and the reason that I hung in here and that Paul and I worked so hard on it is because we felt we were as talented as those guys and that it would be our turn someday, you know,
and
today's the day.
That's right. That day has come for Poco. We are talking with Rusty Young, and I want to ask you about your singing, which it didn't seem like you were allowed, or not allowed, but it didn't seem like there was enough space with all those talents in there early on for Rusty Young to get in there. And now, of course, you've gotten in there in a big way, although it took a long time to be at the driver's seat.
Well, you know, in the band, in the earlier years, there were, with five writers and five singers, it was really, there was no room for me to try and sing and write when I was mostly an instrumentalist. That was my role in the band. I had to hold down the banjo and the dobro and the steel and the guitar and that stuff. So as guys left the band, it gave me a chance to increase my role in the band and my participation. And with fewer writers and fewer singers, when Tim left the band and George left the band, it really gave me a chance to do my thing, which is what I wanted to do too, just like the other guys who had left. So it worked out perfect.
We are talking with Rick Lano out on the deck here, and we plan on doing a full-length interview with you sooner than later. But,
well, thank you.
But you're the drummer in Poco and have been for the last about 5 years.
About 5 years.
And you, there were a lot of gigs in those 5 years. I mean, it reactivated Poco, and also you did some Rusty Young solo gigs together.
That's
but
right.
Usually it was the same band a lot of the time.
That's right. That's right.
And so... what was your experience being on the road with him? Was he someone who was one of the guys, or was he always just the leader?
Not at all playing that leader role. I mean, of course, when somebody has to make a decision at a certain point, and at that point, he is the leader. But up until that point, he's one of the guys. Really stayed in bands, I think, because he really liked being in a band. I think he liked hanging around with the guys. I think he'd like to go to the bar after the show and just tell goofy jokes and break big jokes on each other and do what guys do when they're out on the road. Musically, also, an incredible musician. Rusty Young, I've played, you know, I like to sometimes realize that as far as the great California country rock steel players, I've played with Al Perkins in his own band. I played with Sneaky Pete Kleino and the Flying Breeder Brothers, and played with Rusty Young, and played with Dan Dugmore. And those are the guys.
Those are my four favorites.
That's the California country rock set. Rusty Young is absolutely one of the very best, and I think all three of those guys may even say he's the best. He was really an incredible, sort of a child prodigy. I believe that his parents took him around when he was very young, like 10 and 12, and having, you know, put him up on a band at a bar, and he could just get up there and play with those country guys.
Yeah, you see these cute little pictures of him as a boy.
Yeah.
And there he is behind the pedal steely.
He never really lost that. In fact, I have one of my friends likes to call this picture. I have a picture of him just taken about 1 month before his death, and said, well, that's like the 75-year-old, 12-year-old boy, or I forget how he put it, just like that, though. He still had that spirit of being a 12-year-old kid right to the day he passed away. He really had that, and was fun to be around because of that. But
yeah, what would be some a brief personal remembrance that sticks with you?
Well, That is a hard one. That's a hard one to nail down. It's pretty broad, and I have a whole lot of memories. I was always impressed with just the way that we met when I first met him at Douglas Corner. What a gracious, kind guy he was. I mean, right away, we were thick on music. We liked the same music. And I think as musicians, we both were kind of had a serious side and a goofy side at the same time. But he'd be goofy to a point, and then it would snap, too, to where it was time to, all right, we're going to really sit down and play this thing now. And when it came to that, there would be no slough. He could play very direct because he's a very fine musician. I think we both appreciated that kind of seriousness at the right moment. I always liked the story of just how he got the song. It was passed from one friend in Memphis. Jimmy Davis passed the song to Rusty. He heard the song. He recorded the song.
And this is a song you wrote, co-wrote, called Call It Love.
That I wrote with Ronnie Gilbo and Billy Crane. We didn't even know Rusty at the time. But our friend Jimmy played the song for Rusty as you pointed out a minute ago. Rusty taking a chance of not having a song on there, that he would have had all of the publishing and made all the money, and yet forsook that so that he could sing our song. And then who knew, but it wound up being the hit off the album and the first song released.
We are talking with Paul Cotton, featured member of Poco these days. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be back here. What a show, huh?
Hey, Dolly Parton,
yeah.
Dirt Band, Poco.
Crystal Gale, oh boy. She's in Rusty's room now. No.
You've been writing tunes for so many years, and it's suddenly, all of a sudden, they've been paid attention to. But do you ever regret that some of those others that are back there, some of the gems that are buried on other albums, haven't yet seen the light of day in terms of the general public?
Yeah. Actually, yeah. I would hope that they would have been covered, if not by this band, the original, of course, or covered by other people, you know, other singers. That's a musical term meaning re-recorded again by other people, you know.
Right.
I was hoping for a few. The only one I've had was Bad Weather by Yvonne Elliman.
Yvonne Elliman did Bad Weather?
Yeah. Her first solo album was produced by Steve Cropper, who did the first Poco album I was on, called From the Inside. And he kind of relayed that song to her. She loved it.
How did that happen when you first joined the band? What, you just got a phone call? Someone had heard Illinois Speed Press? What?
I got a phone call from Richie asking me to join the group. And I had to put him off for a day because I just put together the umpteenth version and probably the best version of the Speed Press. Some very heavyweight players. And I was really indecisive about it. I mean, Poco at that time was my favorite band, and I was very at a loss for words. So I had to put Richie off for a day, and consequently, all the guys in the Speed Press, do it, man, do it. That's right where you're at. So I did it. But the call came from one concert the two bands had done together.
Really? Just one show, and you had
one
impressed?
One show in a very small club down in Buena Park, California, called The White Room, and we opened for Poco. That time, the Speed Press was just a four-piece group. We were bare essentials, and so were they at the time. And so they liked the way I played and sang, and it kept me in mind a few months later that it happened.
Many people passed through Poco over the past 53 years, and Rusty Young was there for every single one of them. In the past 35 years or so, 40 years, he was the leader, no question about it, even more than that. Rusty befriended and nurtured every single musician he worked with. I can think of no better person to close out the show than Michael Webb this morning. He was with Poco for several years and left in about 2018, the end of that year, so just about 3 years ago. But The images of them together on stage are indelible because they both played many of the same instruments, mandolin and keyboards and steel guitar and stuff. So anyway, here's Michael Webb and some of his thoughts about Rusty Young, who passed away on April 14th of this year on WXNA LP, Nashville.
I'm sure it's been covered, but the fact that he was a virtuoso multi-instrumentalist that was brought in to be that and then was suddenly tasked with the role of being the leader of the band, and he had no choice but to hunker down and learn how to write hit songs, and then he wrote and sang the biggest hit song in Poco history, Crazy Love. He wrote that, and you know,
yeah,
it's just amazing. He plays acoustic guitar as well as anybody. He was playing a lot of lead electric guitar when I was there with him. Mandolin, fantastic.
And when the band started, I said this in week one, I think, you had all these sort of straight back L.A. Canyon guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're studly. They're like young actors almost.
Yeah.
But they're musicians, okay? It's Richie Furay. I'm in the Buffalo Springfield. It's Jimmy Messina. I'm the producer. I'm in the Buffalo, you know, and it goes on and on, and so Rusty was brought in to fill a particular niche that they couldn't fill because they had steel guitar players like Buddy Cage and others in the area, but they didn't have somebody with a sort of mind that worked the way Rusty's did,
right.
and whoever it was. We've heard the story, but so Benzie Creek led to Poco for Rusty, and he was called out to L.A. and just sat in, and I think half of it was because he was unthreatening, because he had Randy Meisner, who walked out of Poco just because he couldn't even have any input. Messina and Furay are taking over, and that's the deal. So a lot of it has to do with demeanor and personality, you couldn't have found a better one.
And his musical instincts are perfect, and that was one of the things. Like he can think and does. I'm using present tense because if I don't, but he thinks in terms of completing a record the way studio guys get all the, you know, that we do in Nashville. He doesn't just play a bunch of loose and free pedal steel parts just to have them. He constructs for the betterment of the song, and he would do that night after night live too. I remember my wife Anna came to see us at a show in Franklin, and we're driving home, and she just says, God, I love the musical choices he makes. And that sums it up, I think, for everybody.
This is Peter Rodman, and it's time for me to go off by popular demand. Just as we do every week, stay tuned for the French Connection at the top of the hour with our friend Natasha. I'll be back next Monday morning on Memorial Day morning, so while you're setting up your party, you can tune us in, and I promise you we're going to have a swinging, dancing party of our own. I want to thank everybody, and I hope I don't forget any names here, but John Cowan, Bill Lloyd, Jack Sundrud, Tom Hampton, Paul Cotton, Randy Meisner, Richie Furay, Jim Messina. Am I saying things twice now? I can't remember, but all the Pokes. And Michael Webb, my goodness, everybody, I love you, and we'll see you next Monday morning at 10. And Rusty, we love you. Mary, this is for you.
Tonight I'm gonna break away just to wait and see. I'll never be imprisoned by a faded memory. Just when I think I'm over her, this broken heart will mend. I hear her name and I have to cry. The tears come down. time. This crazy love of mine wraps around my heart, refusing to unwind. The stars in a summer sky that fall without a sound, and then pretend that you can't hear these teardrops coming down. It happens all the time, this crazy.